Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Immediately after Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia passed away on Saturday, Republican presidential candidates and members of Congress said the next president should nominate the replacement, not President Obama. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, said he would lead Republicans in blocking any Obama nominee. Talking Points Memo is reporting that outside conservative groups like Freedom Works are preparing to go to war over who should get to pick a replacement for Justice Antonin Scalia. Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat from Massachusetts, reminded Mitch McConnell that Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution says the President of the United States nominates justices to the Supreme Court with the advice and consent of the Senate. So why are the media treating this as a legitimate debate? On Monday, MSNBC sent out a political email with the subject line, "Who should get to pick the next justice?" Joining us to talk about coverage and whether the media should report on this as if it is a legitimate debate is Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and lecturer at Columbia Law School. Scott is author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Foreign Policy. Hi, Scott. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rez. Great to be with you.
It's great to have you. We are also joined by Bob Agelko, legal affairs reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. He's got a very good lengthy piece called How Scalia's Death Impacts Supreme Court's Pending Cases and Future. Hi, Bob. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Great to have you. And the situation in Syria, unfortunately, continues to get worse. As the bombs continue dropping on Aleppo and other areas, there are now talks of a so-called ceasefire, but Syrians say it will not mount to anything. In fact, some people are saying the talks are nothing more than a cruel joke on the Syrian people. The Turkish government is now bombing the Syrian Kurds' positions in Syria, and on top of that, according to reports, Saudi Arabia and Turkey have also threatened a ground invasion. A lot is going on. Joining us to talk about the latest is Borzu Daragahi, a Middle East correspondent with BuzzFeed News. Hi, Borzu. Welcome back to the show. Hi, do we have Borzu?
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and talk about reporting that stood out for you all this week. So, Scott Horton, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I thought it was a really abysmal week for reporting generally. I spent quite a bit of time trying to find something good in terms of campaign coverage, and I gave up. I don't think I found anything. But I found something I thought was clever and amusing, and that was Andrew Boynton's copy editing Trump that's up at the New Yorker right now, where Boynton takes the statement that Donald Trump issued responding to Pope Francis's criticism, in which he said that a man who talks only about building walls and not bridges is not a Christian. And Trump takes that as of course, as a personal insult, and he responds, and he responds in writing. But of course, Boynton gives it a blue pencil editor's review, basically showing how this is filled with meaningless verbiage, and barely articulates the likely ideas that Trump was trying to put forward. So it's a great demonstration at the poor quality of political rhetoric in the country today.
Mm. So, Scott, we really appreciate and respect your opinions about media. You couldn't find anything this week on the election that you liked?
I thought it was pretty bad all around. I thought generally what we see is an obsession with process. You know, it's who's up and who's down in the polls, who's closing the gap, who's moving forward. There's remarkably little attention given to discussion of actual substance and policy. And I think maybe the low point was the MSNBC town hall for Donald Trump that occurred two nights ago with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, in which they gave him one fluffball question after the next for an hour and a half. And he responded, and his responses showed, amongst other things, he didn't know the difference between Medicare and Medicaid and so forth. But his responses were just accepted as they were. There was no effort made to point out the mistakes or errors implicit in what he said. That's very bad reporting.
Yeah, it's getting a lot of attention. And Donald Trump has a phone call almost every morning with Joe Scarborough. And even if he's not in studio, it's just, let's call Donald and have a fluffy conversation. He's getting a lot of criticism for that.
And it's not journalism. That's the problem.
Well, and we'll talk more about that later in the show. Thank you. That's Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's, author of Lords of Secrecy. What about you, Bob Agelko? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Let me try to do it quick and give you two. I like a lot of the coverage about Justice Scalia. I particularly like kind of a spin-off story that the New York Times ran at the top of its paper Monday or Tuesday by Charlie Savage, a superb reporter anyway. This one was a look at how basically the same kind of blockade has been going on in the Senate since the Republicans became a majority with respect to Court of Appeals appointments, far lower profile than the Supreme Court, but still pretty significant all around the country. And it turns out that there's been a policy adopted pretty strictly that unless a Republican senator or senators endorses a nominee, the Senate won't even consider it. And the president apparently stopped even nominating them or putting them forward. As a result, one Court of Appeals judge was confirmed nationwide last year. I think there's 11 or 12 vacancies. I mean, vacancies all over the place. There were hardly any judges confirmed anyway in the Senate, but at the appeals level, it's reached pretty much a blockade stage. And Charlie Savage goes into the history of it and talks to all sides, does an excellent job. Bringing this kind of to the surface, I think it gives some context to the Scalia situation. One other thing I wanted to mention that isn't quite newspaper reporting, but readers of the Chronicle, like me, turned almost immediately off into the back of the datebook section to get our first look at the paper in the morning, columns by John Carroll, now departed, still around, but no longer writing for the Chronicle. But I want to assure readers that if they still have an appetite for John's columns, they continue online in a website called John Carroll Prose. I have quickly put that in my bookmarks, johncarrollprose.com. It's the same witty, insightful stuff, a little less restrained in his use of language, but I would recommend it thoroughly.
Okay, well, thank you, because John Carroll stopped writing his column in the Chronicle recently. And so if you miss John, you can find him at johncarrollprose.com. And then this sounds like a really good piece. Before Scalia's Death, A Clash Between GOP and Obama Over Appellate Judges by Charlie Savage with the New York Times. Thank you for that one, Bob. Bob Agelko is a legal affairs correspondent with the San Francisco Chronicle. And what about you, Borzu Dargahi? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I mean, I saw quite a bit on the foreign beat that was done quite well, but I would just like to sort of send a shout out to a piece by my colleague Monica Mark. She had worked on it over the course of months about Boko Haram, the Nigerian extremist terror group. And really, I mean, this was such a chilling report about the grinding process by which Boko Haram captures certain parts of Nigeria, and then the people who it holds captive and sort of ideologically brainwashes them to become militants or suicide bombers. In particular, she focuses on one teenage woman who has to go through this grueling process where she's stripped of her identity, essentially. And eventually she escapes and tells her story. But it's just a sort of horror story, and it shows some of the extremism that has been produced in certain parts of the world in recent years and what an effort it's going to take to combat this sort of mechanism and this sort of machinery that's already in place in places like Nigeria.
And is she with Mail and Guardian, Monica Mark?
No, Monica's actually with BuzzFeed.
Oh, okay.
She was with Guardian a while ago, but she's actually, I'm just sending a shout out to colleague at BuzzFeed and a new colleague that joined us just this year to cover Africa.
Wow. Well, thank you for that, because we don't really cover Africa, frankly, as much as we should. And so we would love to invite her on a future Friday Media Roundtable. I just found her page at BuzzFeed. Her latest piece is Meet the Women Behind Nigeria's Most Subversive Novellas, Life as a Captive with Boko Haram. These are the superhero Africans that they've created for themselves. It sounds like she's doing some great reporting. So thank you again, Monica Mark at BuzzFeed, and that's Borzu Daragahi, who's Middle East correspondent with BuzzFeed, and we will put links to all of these articles at yourcallradio.org. So, Borzu, let's dive in and talk about what's happening in Syria. It just feels like when we have you on, the situation seems to just keep getting worse. The bombs are dropping on Aleppo and other sites. There are talks of so-called a ceasefire. Syrians say that it won't mount to anything. And then last week, we had the Russians were blamed for airstrikes that killed 50 people after 5 medical facilities and 2 schools were hit in northern Syria. Russia has denied any involvement. Can you just give us an overview? What is happening in Syria right now? Why are things getting worse?
You know, it just seems like there's a real, these sorts of wars drag on and on and on when each side is sort of convinced that it must win and it can win militarily. And I think what you have here is the Russians and the Syrian regime convinced that there's a military solution to the Syrian conflict. You have the Saudis and the Turks seeing that solution as intolerable to their agenda for the region. You have the Iranians viewing this as the conflict and its potential negative outcome for them as an existential threat. And, you know, you have so many different players who have so much at stake in Syria, they're willing to pay the ultimate price for pursuing their goals. And so it's become the ultimate free fire zone. I mean, my heart goes out to the civilians, millions of them still inside the country, inside these war zones, who are struggling to survive. These are often the most poor and vulnerable people who were not able at some point during this conflict to pay for an economy class ticket out of the country and to resettle somewhere else, even to Turkey to take one of these boats and get to Europe. They didn't have enough money for those sorts of trips even. Mm. And so these are the most vulnerable, the weakest, people who are still stuck in the country, basically being shot at by every single sort of armed group, the worst of them being the Russian military, which is basically carpet bombing entire civilian areas of the country in a strategy that it also used in Chechnya some years back.
Can you tell us more about Russian involvement?
Well, I think that, you know, it was on September 30th when the Russians began airstrikes. They claimed they were fighting against ISIS, and they were going to join the international effort to defeat ISIS in Syria. But, you know, the huge majority of their bombing campaigns, 80%, have been targeting other groups other than ISIS and rebel-held territories other than those held by ISIS, including relatively moderate, albeit often Islamist, rebel groups that are in some ways supported or financed or vetted by the United States. And they've been pummeling these people without really going after ISIS. So many people are very curious about their strategy in this regard. Are they trying to fight extremism or shore up Bashar al-Assad's regime by turning Syria into a Manichean battle between Bashar al-Assad and ISIS?
And Borzu, there's a story out of the Boston Globe that has been getting a lot of attention. You've been tweeting about it. It's called "The Media Are Misleading the Public on Syria." It was written by Stephen Kinzer, a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University. He starts off by saying coverage of the Syrian war will be remembered as one of the most shameful episodes in the history of the American press. Reporting about carnage in the ancient city of Aleppo is the latest reason why. He says this month, people in Aleppo have finally seen glimmers of hope. The Syrian militants' hold on the city could be ending. He talks about how important news from the world now comes from reporters based in Washington because so many foreign bureaus have shut down. I'm noticing that this piece is getting a lot of attention on social media.
I think it's really sad because I used to respect Stephen Kinzer. But, you know, he's just sort of, you know, part of the reflexive left that buys a lot of BS from Bashar al-Assad's regime, and you know, what's happening in Aleppo is completely wrong. He has no idea what he's talking about, I'll say this. Whatever. He says the reporting is coming out of Washington, D.C. because all of the foreign bureaus have shut down. Me and my colleague Mike Giglio are at the Syrian border basically 2 or 3 times a month, Mike Giglio himself, as my colleague, has been in Syria recently, albeit not to Aleppo. It's too dangerous. But, you know, we all traveled inside Syria. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's a dinosaur from a previous era. He's a lost guy punching in the dark.
And for people who are posting this story, I mean, what is your main problem with his argument? Because it is getting a lot of attention.
He has no idea what he's talking about. He's wrong. That's my main argument. He has no idea what he's talking about. No one is welcoming Bashar al-Assad and the Russian regime carpet bombing central Aleppo except Bashar al-Assad and the Russian regime. I mean, he just doesn't know what he's talking about. He doesn't talk to people. He doesn't have any sources. He's just talking, I don't know what. Hmm. I'm not sure where he's.
Is it Scott Horton or Bob Agelko, if you've been paying attention to Syria and the media coverage that it's getting and stories like this, do you have any questions for Borzoo Dargahi?
Well, I would say, you know, first of all, I think he's correct that this Kinzer piece makes some mistakes. I mean, in particular, Kinzer says that the Assad regime is the only force fighting ISIS, which, of course, is completely ridiculous. But I think he's right on a fundamental point, which is when you look at a lot of the reporting that occurs that's reported out of Washington, it has a particular political twist. So it's presenting the Syrian rebels as some sort of romantic and glorious opposing force, and there's an advocacy for more U.S. intervention in the background. And in fact, it generally fails to present the situation in anything like the complexity that obviously attaches to it. I mean, there are many, many different communities within Syria. It's a crazy quilt patchwork sort of a place. So I think this is one of the areas where he's right in that there hasn't been the sort of detailed discussion and nuanced policy discussion about what U.S. policy towards Syria should be. There's only been rather weak advocacy of further intervention without really studying the viability of that intervention.
And Borzoo, I noticed that the Russian bombings, I believe, were missing from the piece by Stephen Kinzer.
I mean, what can I say? I mean, like I said, he just doesn't know what he's talking about. He's just, you know, there's a sort of virulent strain of anti-Americanism among the left that basically views anyone that opposes the U.S. as somehow good. And I think that poor Stephen Kinzer, once he was a really good reporter, but he's fallen into that trap of, you know, so the Russians are doing this and Bashar is doing this and the Americans are against them. Mm. So they... and the Americans must be bad, and it's really juvenile, kind of a relic of a previous era. Doesn't look at the complexities of what's happening on the ground, doesn't look at the various interests in state. I don't know about Washington reporting. I tend to ignore it because it's a lot of BS. But I can tell you that my colleagues covering Syria from the ground, going into the country when we could, Liz Sly of the Washington Post, Anne Bernard of the New York Times, Anthony Shadid, bless his soul, when he was on this earth before he passed away covering Syria, we were, you know, adamant about describing, and we have been adamant about describing the complexities, the ethnic complexities, the interests at stake in the Syria conflict.
Well,
and just to add to the point that Scott had been making earlier about political coverage, this has come up in the debates in both parties, and particularly I've heard in the Democratic debate where, Hillary Clinton is proposing one thing, a no-fly zone, and Bernie Sanders is proposing it's hard to tell what. And the press coverage seems to make neither head nor tail out of either the proposals or the background. And I'm trying to differentiate between candidates and administration policy here and not having too much success. And I wonder if maybe we could get a little enlightenment from a closer perspective.
And Borzoo, we're getting a few emails saying, what should the United States actually do?
Yeah, that's sort of my question.
Yeah, Borzoo, and then we'll let you go.
I mean, thank God I don't have to answer that question at this point. But I mean, I'm not a policy person. I think that the U.S. has made many, many mistakes with regard to Syria policy. But I do think that the most critical and most crucial thing that right now the whole international community should do and could do is to protect civilian life in Syria. These are not, rats that are being killed, and that any effort that we can take to preserve civilian life and civilian institutions in these areas that are under constant bombardment. Any aid that we can provide, any safe zones that we can create, however we can create them, any lines in the sand we can draw with regard to the slaughter, the wholesale slaughter of ordinary people would be helpful and humane and put us on the right side of history at this point.
Well, Borzu, thank you again for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. That's Borzu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent with BuzzFeed. And as is always the case, the people suffer here. One of his latest pieces is Syrians fleeing the growing offensive in Aleppo are living through hell. With the Turkish border closed and Syrian and allied Russian forces pummeling Aleppo, tens of thousands of Syrians are braving harsh winter nights unprotected while seeking safety. And you can read Borzu's piece at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after the break, Scott Horton with Harper's and Bob Agelka with the San Francisco Chronicle will talk about and analyze media coverage of the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, his legacy, and what's next for the Supreme Court. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll-free number. You can also send an email to feedback at yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point. Stay with us here on Local Public Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we will talk about the best Bay Area hikes. We are lucky to be surrounded by so much beautiful nature in the Bay Area. On Tuesday, we'll talk about what the Flint, Michigan water crisis reveals about neoliberal governance. And how far does this stretch? We'll talk about Turkey also next week. And we'll discuss DuPont's decades-long history of chemical pollution. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with reporters about coverage of some of the week's top stories. Scott Horton is contributing editor with Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Foreign Policy. Bob Agelka is legal affairs reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. I hope you can check out Bob's piece, How Scalia's Death Impacts Supreme Court's Pending Cases and Its Future. And if you'd like to join us to talk about the bizarre coverage of Supreme Court Antonin Scalia justice and what's next for the Supreme Court, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Scott Horton, I say it's bizarre because right after Scalia died, immediately after, Republicans came out and said the next president should nominate a replacement, not President Obama. Mitch McConnell said he would lead Republicans in blocking any Obama nominee. And then that was the frame from there on out. On Monday, as I said earlier, MSNBC sent out an email with the subject line, who should get to pick the next justice? Scott, is this a legitimate question?
Find a constitutional scholar or legal scholar of any kind in the United States who thinks there is any issue there. But I think it's the way it's been presented. So I would say there is no question. It's the president who puts forward a nominee. He has a responsibility to do so. The Senate has a responsibility to evaluate and vote on the nominee. Those are the rules, the legal rules. On the other hand, it has regularly been the case that in the lame duck period of a presidency, when the Senate is in the control of another political party, there is a conscious effort to slow walk the process, to slow down or even stop the process of appointing federal judges generally. And we've seen that many, many times. In fact, I'd say over the last decade, it's clearly getting more severe than it has been at earlier periods. But, you know, we know this sort of guerrilla warfare over nominations occurred in the middle of the 19th century, too. So it's not unique. What's different here is throwing down the gauntlet and announcing it as a change in doctrine in terms of the powers and prerogatives of the president immediately after Scalia's death was announced. Nothing like that's happened before.
Bob, how do you think the media should deal with this? Eric Bullard, senior fellow at Media Matters, writes, in the wake of Scalia's death, the Beltway press almost immediately began to seamlessly frame the unfolding debate about his replacement along the contours of Republican talking points. And Talking Points Memo just came out with a piece yesterday saying that these conservative groups like FreedomWorks said that they're going to go to war over this. Kurt Levy, executive director of FreedomWorks, said, "The strategy that makes the most sense is to say that there should not be any consideration of this nominee. It would be irrelevant to have a hearing because it's the situation, the fact that it's an election year, the fact that his policies are before the court, and the court is so finely balanced at the moment." That's what he said. So how should the media deal with this? Bob?
You obviously have to report this as not only Kurt Levy talking, whose group is on kind of one edge of the even the Republican Party, but the Republican leadership talking. I mean, it wasn't just, I mean, I've seen comparisons of this, you know, Democratic opposition to Robert Bork, to Senator Obama's and Hillary Clinton's, in fact, choice to filibuster Samuel Alito, which was kind of split the Democratic Party and did not succeed. The nomination was eventually approved, of course, in 2006. But here we have a party saying, and I don't remember when this has happened before, not only are we, you know, opposed to nominee X, but anyone that this president proposes, at least it was indicated by Senator McConnell right away, not even going to get a hearing. I mean, they seem to have backed off some consent, or at least Senator Grassley, chairman of the Senate Judiciary, it sort of implied that maybe we'll give them a hearing before we vote them down. But I think that the context belongs in coverage more than it's been. Words like unprecedented, hard line, or something like that, indicating that this is a departure from practice. Yeah, nominations have been slow walked. It's mainly been in the case of lower court judges, because we haven't had many Supreme Court vacancies. This is the second justice to die in office in 60 years after Chief Justice Rehnquist. There wasn't one since the 50s. So these vacancies don't normally occur at this point. But yeah, I think that press coverage ought to stress the unusual or extreme nature of the stance that's being taken, which doesn't mean that it won't succeed. I mean, according to polls I've seen, just about half the public thinks that, or close to half the public thinks that this nomination should be pushed over until the next election. So evidently the messenger has communicated with people. Obviously the answer is the people have already had a say. They elected President Obama for two terms, and his second term lasts 4 years, and for the Republicans to say they won't even consider it or to guarantee that they'll reject it doesn't seem to be advised to consent. It's not advised, reject, and sit on our hands against the chance that we will win. And it should be added that while they say the next president should make the choice, if the next president is a Democrat, what do you want to bet that a Republican Senate will give that person a full hearing and not filibuster? I would doubt it.
Well, and we'll talk about Scalia's record in just a minute, but because you said the public is now kind of on board with this, is it surprising, Scott Horton, because you've got the New York Times saying that the death has sparked an immediate partisan battle? Well, who sparked this battle? The AP says, frame the unfolding story as Obama's announcement being a direct rebuttal to Senate Republicans. BuzzFeed says the vacancy is different because the justice was a rock-solid conservative seat. And given the divisions on the court, conservatives will be adamant that one of their own replace him.
Well, of course, there's no such thing as rock-solid conservative seats. You know, the composition of the court has varied over time, consistently based on this particular nominees and based on the flow of presidents who have the nominations to make. And we have right now, you know, arguably the most conservative court we've had since the New Deal. So every anticipation is, of course, that it would flow in the other direction. It will become his replacement would most likely be far more moderate than him. And I think that's the reason why we see this battle royal in the making right now. But, yeah, I think the amazing thing here is that the Republicans decided to frame this issue, and the framing was largely accepted by the media, by large parts of the media. So they've had a success to that extent.
Well, we have a caller who wants to talk about coverage of Scalia's death and implications. Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose. I do agree that the media needs to take the tack of reporting and not taking the talking points. A lame duck, as I understand it, is after an election, which would be in November. So Obama, with 5 million votes in the 2012 election, is still an acting president. And the math for a Democratic tie in many of the states, let's just say the Democratic race, would lead to a Supreme Court decision like Gore versus Bush, and you need a Supreme Court judge on the court, not a 4-4 decision, but a 5-4 decision, and that alone should bring Congress to their senses. But the media does need to stop parroting, I believe, the talking points of the particular nominees that are running and also the extremists. Thank you.
Well, thank you for calling in. Bob, you wrote about the prospect of 4-4 deadlocks on some of the most important cases in this term, which runs through June. What really stood out for you?
Well, I guess the case that's the most obvious is going to most likely turn around is the teachers union case, the Friedrichs case, California case, where the court appeared after arguments to be ready to rule, as Justice Alito has sought for some years, that public employee unions may no longer collect fees from non-members for the cost of representing them. This was said to violate freedom of speech by having to give money to a labor organization whose views you disagree with. It was said that everything a public employee union does is political, at least said by the proponents in the lawsuit, and Justice Scalia said so during oral argument. It seemed to be pretty clearly 5-4 to do that, to overturn a 1977 precedent. Now the court is split 4-4. If they do what they frequently do in these cases and say the court is equally divided, the lower court ruling stands. The lower court ruling leaves the current system in place. The public employee unions get to continue collecting their fees, at least until a new case might arise if a Republican wins the presidency and appoints the new justice. There's certainly President Obama's immigration order granting reprieve from deportation to the parents of legal U.S. residents, so more than 4 million of them. Lower court has issued a nationwide injunction in a suit by Republican-led states. The case hasn't been up for argument yet, but if the court had affirmed it 5-4, of course, this would put an end to the order. A 4-4 split would leave the lower court ruling in place. It's not at all certain that will happen because there's questions about whether the states have suffered enough injury to proceed, and there are some conservative justices who might not find they had standing. But even a 4-4 ruling that let it stand would probably be only temporary, because if a Democratic president were to come in the court, the landscape would change. Hmm. Affirmative action, voter representation, whether a legislature should represent equally registered voters or the whole population, as is often the case now, and abortion, a Texas law that would close more than half of the state's abortion clinics. other cases that where the courts would seem to be closely divided, and the the death of Justice Scalia changes everything.
It changes everything. Scott Horton, these are major cases, and June is just, what, 4.5 months away?
I think that's right. And you know, I would stress, in fact, the injunction that the Supreme Court issued staying the enforcement of the EPA's emissions regulations of coal-fired power plants, that's an unprecedented step by the Supreme Court. Wouldn't have, and that only happened on, I guess, the 8th or 9th of February, so just shortly before Scalia's death, without his vote, wouldn't have happened. This is something that's getting more attention outside of the United States than inside the United States, because headlines all over Europe right now are U.S. Supreme Court blocks America's compliance with its commitments from the Paris Accords. And that's really exactly what's going on. Pretty outrageous act by a court.
We have an email from Paul who says, I want to recommend a piece published in the New York Times in 2008, written by Jeffrey Rosen, called Supreme Court Inc. Rosen explored the way both parties have been appointing judges throughout the federal judiciary who will support the judicial agenda of the U.S. business community. We've done some shows about this, and Scott, you've written about this.
Absolutely. I mean, in fact, I would say, even just look at the circumstances of Judge Scalia's death here, which I think most people, not wanting to raise the issue around the time of his death haven't explored. But, he died at a luxurious ranch in Presidio County, Texas, where he was occupying a presidential suite, $700 to $800 a night. He was booked in there for a week, and then we discover that the costs of his mini vacation for quail hunting were being covered by an entity that had a case recently before the court. We have these close connections between very conservative advocacy organizations and commercial interests, Chamber of Commerce interests, affecting judicial nominees across the board and affecting judges. I mean, particularly justices of the Supreme Court who have been taking luxury vacations on their dime. And that's not an ethics issue in terms of any clear ethics rule that's violated, because there are no ethics rules for the justices of the Supreme Court. If Nino Scalia had been a justice of the Court of Appeals somewhere, this would have been a big question. But for a justice of the Supreme Court, it's not.
Hmm. The LA Times had a piece about this, saying that Texas millionaire John Poindexter invited Scalia to this ranch. Is there anything we need to know just about the case that you cited, that there was a case that was coming up that's connected to this?
That was decided in the last term.
And what was that one?
So, and that had to do, it was definitely a corporate interest case relating to tax issues.
And if you'd like to join us today, we're talking about coverage of Justice Scalia's death and what's next for the Supreme Court. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's, author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite, and America's Stealth Foreign Policy. Bob Agelko is a legal affairs reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Let's talk more about his legacy. Andrew Cohen with the Brennan Center for Justice writes, Scalia's friendship with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg always is cited as an example of Scalia's personal appeal, but that quaint beltway friendship and the fact that Scalia was, by all accounts, entertaining at cocktail parties did not help the millions of litigants, employees, minorities, the poor, whose lives were made measurably worse by the votes he issued in his decades on the court. For those people through the years, Scalia's notion of constitutional originalism was merely another lawyer's word that meant they were going to lose. Bob Agelko, what really strikes you about some of the major cases Scalia was involved with and also spoke out for or against?
The number of his majority opinions was fairly limited. I mean, he's often said to have been the leader or the most outspoken member of the court's conservative bloc, and I suppose that's so. But he wasn't assigned very many big cases by the Chief Justice. I suppose the most prominent one was the Heller case, the gun case in 2008, when he said that the Second Amendment, as properly interpreted with his originalist philosophy, guarantees a personal right to have handguns in the home for self-defense. Now, it's certainly been said in criticism of his claim to originalism that this ignored the first sentence of the Second Amendment, which talked about a well-regulated militia. Be that as it may, it's certainly been an influential ruling. Scalia himself sort of moderated it by saying that there are certain kinds of weapons and certain sorts of places that states can regulate, and they have. And what a new court and a new justice will certainly affect is how broadly this ruling applies. But he was obviously a key member of the 5-4 majority in the Citizens United case, the one that allowed unlimited corporate spending for political causes, in the Shelby County case recently that basically removed the key provision of the Voting Rights Act, an act incidentally in which Scalia was personally very disdainful. He called it racial entitlements. On affirmative action, he questioned in recent oral argument whether blacks really belonged at upper-end universities like the University of Texas. He was disdainful of gays and lesbians and some of his dissents, and his dissent in the marriage ruling and in other rulings. He has compared it to bestiality and the like, not necessarily saying that they were the same, but saying that people oppose one, they could oppose the other. But yeah, he was a fairly reliable vote in most areas for the court's conservative majority, with the exception of some criminal cases in which his view of the Constitution was that people should be able to confront opposing witnesses. So he's limited hearsay evidence by the prosecution. He has said that juries, not judges, should have the deciding a word on death sentences and so forth. But there are a number of doctrines now, the guns being one, Citizens United being another, and the death penalty itself possibly being in play with a new court, given Justice Breyer's recent opinion, the question of the constitutionality of capital punishment. It could be that the new court will scale back or even overturn the death penalty.
Scott, Citizens United was huge, and Politico had a piece called Scalia's death could now shake up campaign finance. It might be the opening reformers have been waiting for.
Well, I think that's exactly right. So, I think, in fact, if you look at Nino Scalia's conservatism, it's different from what we've seen as judicial conservatism through most of the history of the American courts. It's a cultural conservatism. It's sort of a Southern European throne and altar type of conservatism that doesn't accept the liberal foundation of the American Constitution, in fact. So I think he himself recognized that he was part of a small minority, and I think he also recognized that his legacy was not likely to be a long-lasting legacy. In fact, I think there's one point where he compared himself to Justice Sutherland, who was one of the four horsemen from the pre-New Deal court, whose legacy consisted entirely of obstruction, blocking and obstructing the New Deal. And I think Scalia also views himself as someone who has tried to stop progress on social issues and other issues. And I think his major accomplishment probably was the changes in voting rights and political process. Citizens United and Shelby County, those two decisions are, although, he wasn't author of these decisions, he was, to a large extent, intellectual author of them. It's his ideas that form the basis for the arguments that led to those decisions. And will those decisions hold? In my view, very hard to see how they continue to hold up in a new Supreme Court. They're going to face ferocious challenge, and in my view, very unlikely we're going to see a next justice or next several justices approved who will embrace that mode of analysis. I think they're going to fall.
Mugambi Jue at Slate wrote, "A critical part of Scalia's troubling legacy has long been staring us in the face, although it finally started receiving the public scrutiny it deserves in recent years. As draconian punishments became the norm over the last three decades, the Supreme Court largely rubber-stamped these practices. Scalia played a key role in this process, as his hardline stances on criminal punishment significantly contributed to mass incarceration, numerous executions, and systemic racial discrimination." What about that, Scott, as we're having a pretty intense conversation in this country right now about these issues?
Well, I think it's one of the issues where he's definitely on the wrong side of history. In fact, you know, he had a pretty cold heart about what about these fundamental questions of criminal justice and the entire machinery of criminal justice. In his view, there was no guarantee of a correct result, that we absolutely had to be prepared to accept executing innocent people. There was nothing fundamentally the matter with that. We had just so much in funds and time to expend on a criminal justice process. The process would tick along, and when it reached a result, that was the result. And if it turns out later that serious mistakes were made and it was the wrong result, well, too bad. That's the Scalia view. Very rare are the number of people on the political stage or among federal judges who are prepared to openly embrace that view.
What would you add, Bob?
Well, I guess one remarkable thing about Justice Scalia, and he's made some speaking appearances out here that I've gotten to cover, is his certainty by which he asserts his view. He said things like, these are easy questions. Abortion, homosexuality, the death penalty, come on, piece of cake. There's nothing in the Constitution that refers to abortion or homosexuality. Death penalty, you know, the founders contemplated it. What are you talking about here? Which, you know, these are issues that really have split the political sphere and have split the courts. But for Justice Scalia, they were easy questions, which is probably one reason that he did not manage to attract the majority for some of his views, because there wasn't much bend here. There wasn't much room for meet you halfway. There's not much of a Sandra Day O'Connor approach to it. In fact, he put down Justice O'Connor some time ago, which was in one of her abortion rulings, I believe, which is probably a reason why the court came out the way it did. Now, evidently, he, charming in person, but not on paper. On paper, he was kind of my way, and if you don't agree with it, you just gotta wise up.
Well, we have time for one more caller. Let's go to Kevin in San Francisco. Hi, Kevin.
Yeah, hi, Rose. Great show as usual. There's a really good piece in the current issue of Bloomberg Business Week that pretty much rips him up. Scalia changed the rules for who could sue, and not in a way that helped the little guy. He was key in the ruling that protected Comcast against a monopolization suit brought on behalf of 2 million cable subscribers. He was key in the Walmart case blocking a women's discrimination lawsuit that represented 1.5 million female employees. So he's left his legacy of making it more difficult for citizens, unions, environmental groups to have standing to even get a day in court. So very restrictive and very sort of moving toward fascism.
Wow. Well, thank you. This looks like a great piece, Bloomberg Business, How Scalia Kept the Little Guys Out of Court by Paul Barrett. The late justice left one of his greatest marks in restricting court access. Scott Horton?
Well, I agree. I mean, I think it's an important point, and it focuses on his notion of access to justice, which is, yes, our system is created for the wealthy and powerful, and, that's the way it is.
Well, and so where does this go from here? Because Paul Campos with Salon has a piece, 2016 is now all about the Supreme Court. This is how Justice Scalia's death deadlocks the court and changes the presidential race. He writes, This brings us, the 5-4 decisions that will now feature 4-4 votes and a tie, brings us to the political implications of Scalia's death. These seem destined to have a big effect on the presidential race and various Senate contests around the country. Every 4 years, we hear that the winner of the election may well play a key role in shaping the court for decades to come. He writes, this will not be a hypothetical scenario in 2016, because two things seem very highly likely. Senate Republicans will not approve anyone Obama nominates, and the next president will at the very least end up choosing two Supreme Court justices, if not more. So this is a big deal, Scott.
I think absolutely correct. I think the Supreme Court, you know, in the last weeks of every presidential campaign, it always figures in these final rallies, you know, this presidency is going to decide the makeup of the Supreme Court. Well, that's always said, and it's possibly true, but this time it really will be the case. So I think we're going to have a focus on the Supreme Court, its makeup, and Supreme Court decision-making like in no prior election. It's going to be front and center.
And it just speaks to how important the media are in these cases. Leslie just writes in, so now there's a new rule that once the court has a conservative majority, they have dibs on those 5 seats forever. Has the whole country gone mad? I mean, this speaks to the importance of media coverage, right, Scott?
Well, absolutely. And it shows, you know, the media sometimes blithely accepts political talking points without labeling them as political talking points. That's the danger.
Well, I hope that everybody can go read the articles we talked about today and also this one from Talking Points Memo, because this deserves a lot more attention. Outside groups warn Republicans do not even think about holding a Supreme Court hearing. And they quoted some people from Freedom Works, but they're basically saying if you even consider this, there's going to be an all-out war. So we will definitely continue to follow this. Scott Horton is a contributing editor with Harper's Magazine, author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite, and America's Stealth Foreign Policy. Bob Agelko is legal affairs reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Bob and Scott, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. And sorry about Bob's line. We got a few calls about that. But thank you for calling, and thanks for all of your emails. This is your call, and we'll have a good weekend. We'll see you on Monday. On the next Your Call, we're talking about the best Bay Area hikes. El Nino storms have brought a windfall of rain, turning our hillsides emerald green, dotted with a rainbow of wildflowers, and waterfalls are gushing in full force. We are surrounded by so many beautiful trails. So what is your favorite Bay Area hike, and what do you love about our great outdoors? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David Latulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.